Not back at once. I'll hunt a bit on the way back. We've no food with us, and I dinna want to attract attention by stopping at a croft. Pull the tartan up over your head and make sure it covers your shift. The white shoes for a long way.
Food seemed irrelevant. I felt as though I would never want to eat again. Sleep was something else again. My back and arms still ached, the rope burns on my wrist were raw, and I felt sore and bruised all over. But worn out with fear, pain, and simple exhaustion, I fell asleep almost at once, the pungent scent of ferns rising around me like incense. I awoke with something gripping my foot. Startled, I sat up straight, crashing into the springy branches overhead. Leaves and sticks showered down around me, and I flailed my arms wildly, trying to disengage my hair from the snagging twigs. Scratched, dishevelled, and irritated, I crawled out of my sanctuary to find an amused Jamie squatting nearby, watching my emergence. It was near sunset. The sun had dropped below the lip of the burn, leaving the rocky canyon in shadow. The smell of roasting meat rose from a small fire burning among the rocks near the stream, where two rabbits browned on a makeshift spit made of sharpened green sticks. Jamie held out a hand to help me down the slope. I haughtily declined and swept down myself, tripping only once on the trailing ends of the plaid. My earlier nausea had vanished, and I fell ravenously on the meat.
"We'll move up into the forest after supper, Sassenach," Jamie said, tearing a joint from the rabbit carcass. "I dinna want to sleep near the burn. I canna hear anyone coming over the noise of the water."
There wasn't much conversation as we ate. The horror of the morning and the thought of what we had left behind oppressed us both. And for me, there was a profound sense of mourning. I had lost not only the chance of finding out more about the why and wherefore of my presence here, but a friend as well. My only friend. I was often in doubt as to Geely's motives, but I had no doubt at all that she had saved my life that morning. Knowing herself doomed, she had done her best to give me a chance of escape. The fire, almost invisible in daylight, was growing brighter now as darkness filled the burn. I looked into the flames, seeing the crisp skin and brown bones of the rabbits on their spits. A drop of blood from a broken bone fell into the fire, hissing into nothing. Suddenly, the meat stuck in my throat. I set it down hastily and turned away, retching. Still without speaking much, we moved out of the burn and found a comfortable place near the edge of a clearing in the forest. Hills rose in undulant mounds all around us, but Jamie had chosen a high spot with a good view of the road from the village. The dusk momentarily heightened all the colours of the countryside, lighting the land with jewels, a glowing emerald in the hollows, a lovely shadowed amethyst among the clumps of heather, and burning rubies on the red-berried rowan trees that crowned the hills. Rowan berries, a specific against witchcraft. Far in the distance, the outline of Castle Leoch was still visible at the foot of Ben Aden. It faded quickly as the light died. Jamie made a fire in a sheltered spot and sat down next to it. The rain had eased to a faint drizzle that misted the air and spangled my eyelashes with rainbows when I looked at the flames. He sat staring into the fire for a long time. Finally, he looked up at me, hands clasped around his knees.
"I said before that I'd not ask you things you had no wish to tell me. And I'd not ask you now. But I must know, for your safety as well as mine."
He paused, hesitating.
"Claire, if you've never been honest with me, be so now, for I must know the truth. Claire, are ye a witch?"
I gaped at him. "A witch? You can really ask that?" I thought he must be joking. He wasn't. He took me by the shoulders and gripped me hard, staring into my eyes as though willing me to answer him.
I must ask it, Claire. And you must tell me.
And if I were, I asked through dry lips, if you had thought I were a witch, would you still have fought for me?
I would have gone to the stake with you, he said violently, and to hell beyond if I must.
But may the Lord Jesus have mercy on my soul and on yours. Tell me the truth. The strain of it all caught up with me. I tore myself out of his grasp and ran across the clearing. Not far, only to the edge of the trees. I couldn't bear the exposure of the open space. I clutched a tree, put my arms around it, and dug my fingers hard into the bark, pressed my face to it, and shrieked with hysterical laughter. Jamie's face, white and shocked, loomed up on the other side of the tree. With a dim realization that what I was doing must sound unnervingly like cackling, I made a terrific effort and stopped. Panting, I stared at him for a moment. Yes, I said, backing away, still heaving with gasps of unhinged laughter. Yes, I am a witch. To you, I must be. I've never had smallpox, but I can walk through a room full of dying men and never catch it. I can nurse the sick and breathe their air and touch their bodies, and the sickness can't touch me. I can't catch cholera either, or lockjaw, or the morbid sore throat. And you must think it's an enchantment because you've never heard of vaccine and there's no other way you can explain it. The things I know. I stopped backing away and stood still, breathing heavily, trying to control myself. I know about Jonathan Randall because I was told about him. I know when he was born and when he'll die. I know about what he's done and what he'll do. I know about Sandringham because Frank told me. He knew about Randall because he... Oh, God. I felt as though I might be sick and closed my eyes to shut out the spinning stars overhead. And Colum, he thinks I'm a witch because I know Hamish isn't his own son. I know he can't sire children. But he thought I knew who Hamish's father is. I thought maybe it was you, but then I knew it couldn't be, and... I was talking faster and faster, trying to keep the vertigo at bay with the sound of my own voice. Everything I've ever told you about myself was true, I said, nodding madly as though to reassure myself. Everything. I haven't any people. I haven't any history. Because I haven't happened yet. Do you know when I was born? I asked, looking up. I knew my hair was wild and my eyes staring, and I didn't care. On the 20th of October, in the year of our Lord, 1918. Do you hear me? I demanded, for he was blinking at me, unmoving, as though paying no attention to a word I said. I said 1918, nearly 200 years from now. Do you hear? I was shouting now, and he nodded slowly.
I hear, he said softly.
Yes, you hear, I blazed. And you think I'm raving mad, don't you? Admit it. That's what you think. You have to think so. There isn't any other way you can explain me to yourself. You can't believe me. You can't dare to. Oh, Jamie. I felt my face start to crumple. All this time spent hiding the truth, realizing that I could never tell anyone. And now I realize that I could tell Jamie, my beloved husband, the man I trusted beyond all others. And he wouldn't, he couldn't believe me either. It was the rocks, the fairy hill, the standing stones, Merlin stones. That's where I came through. I was gasping, half sobbing, becoming less coherent by the second. Once upon a time, but it's really 200 years. It's always 200 years in the stories. But in the stories, the people always get back. I couldn't get back. I turned away, staggering, grasping for support. I sat down on a rock, shoulders slumped, and put my head in my hands. There was a long silence in the wood. It went on long enough for the small night birds to recover their courage and start their noises once again, calling to each other with a thin, high zeek as they hawked for the last insects of the summer. I looked up at last, thinking that perhaps he had simply risen and left me, overcome by my revelations. He was still there, though, still sitting, hands braced on his knees, head bowed as though in thought. The hairs on his arms shone stiff as copper wires in the firelight, though, and I realized that they stood erect, like the bristles on a dog. He was afraid of me. "Jamie," I said, feeling my heart break with absolute loneliness. "Oh, Jamie." I sat down and curled myself into a ball, trying to roll myself around the core of my pain. Nothing mattered anymore, and I sobbed my heart out. His hands on my shoulders raised me enough to see his face. Through the haze of tears, I saw the look he wore in battle, of struggle that had passed the point of strain and become calm certainty. "I believe you," he said firmly. "I dinna understand it a bit, not yet, but I believe you. Claire, I believe you. Listen to me. There's the truth between us, you and I, and whatever you tell me, I shall believe it." He gave me a gentle shake. "It doesna matter what it is. You've told me. That's enough for now. Be still, Madonna. Lay your head and rest. You'll tell me the rest of it later, and I'll believe you." I was still sobbing, unable to grasp what he was telling me. I struggled, trying to pull away, but he gathered me up and held me tightly against himself, pushing my head into the folds of his plaid, and repeating over and over again, "I believe you." At last, from sheer exhaustion, I grew calm enough to look up and say, "But you can't believe me." He smiled down at me. His mouth trembled slightly, but he smiled. "You'll no tell me what I canna do, Sassenach." He paused a moment. "How old are you?" he asked curiously. "I never thought to ask." The question seemed so preposterous that it took me a minute to think. "I'm 27, or maybe 28, I added. That rattled him for a moment. At 28, women in this time were usually on the verge of middle age. "Oh," he said. He took a deep breath. "I thought you were about my age, or younger." He didn't move for a second, but then he looked down and smiled faintly at me. "Happy birthday, Sassenach," he said. It took me completely by surprise, and I just stared stupidly at him for a moment. "What?" I managed at last. "I said, happy birthday. It's the 20th of October today."
"Is it?"
I said dumbly. I'd lost track. I was shaking again from cold and shock and the force of my tirade. He drew me close against him and held me, smoothing his big hands lightly over my hair, cradling my head against his chest. I began to cry again, but this time with relief. In my state of upheaval, it seemed logical that if he knew my real age and still wanted me, then everything would be all right. Jamie picked me up, and holding me carefully against his shoulder, carried me to the side of the fire where he had laid the horse's saddle. He sat down, leaning against the saddle, and held me light and close. A long time later, he spoke. "All right. Tell me now." I told him. Told him everything, haltingly but coherently. I felt numb from exhaustion, but content, like a rabbit that has outrun a fox and found temporary shelter under a log. It isn't sanctuary, but at least it is respite. And I told him about Frank.
"Frank," he said softly. "Then he isna dead after all."
"He isn't born." I felt another small wave of hysteria break against my ribs, but managed to keep myself under control. Neither am I. He stroked and patted me back into silence, making his small, murmuring Gaelic sounds.
"When I took you from Randall at Fort William," he said suddenly, "you were trying to get back. Back to the Stones and Frank. That's where you left the groove."
"Yes."
"And I beat you for it."
His voice was soft with regret. "You couldn't know. I couldn't tell you." I was beginning to feel very drowsy indeed.
"No, I didn't suppose you could."
He pulled the plaid closer around me, tucking it gently around my shoulders.
"Do you sleep now, my Dunya? No one shall harm you. I'm here."
I burrowed into the warm curve of his shoulder, letting my tired mind fall through the layers of oblivion. I forced myself to the surface long enough to ask, "Do you really believe me, Jamie?" He sighed and smiled ruefully down at me.
"Aye, I believe you, Sassenach. But it would have been a good deal easier if you'd only been a witch."
I slept like the dead, awakening sometime after dawn with a terrible headache, stiff in every muscle. Jamie had a few handfuls of oats in a small bag in his sporran, and forced me to eat drammach, oats mixed with cold water. It stuck in my throat, but I choked it down. He was slow and gentle with me, but spoke very little. After breakfast, he quickly packed up the small campsite and saddled Donas. Numb with the shock of recent events, I didn't even ask where we were going. Mounted behind him, I was content to rest my face against the broad slope of his back, feeling the motion of the horse rock me into a state of mindless trance. We came down from the braes near Loch Maddoch, pressing through the chilly dawn mist to the edge of a still sheet of grey. Wild ducks began to rise from the reeds in untidy flocks that circled the marshes, quacking and calling to rouse late sleepers below. By contrast, a well-disciplined wedge of geese passed over us, calling of heartbreak and desolation. The grey fog lifted near midday on the second day, and a weak sun lighted the meadows filled with yellow gorse and broom. A few miles past the loch, we came out onto a narrow road and turned northwest. The way took us up again, rising into low, rolling hills that gave way gradually to granite tors and crags. We met few travellers on the road, and prudently turned aside into the brush whenever hoofbeats were heard ahead. The vegetation turned to pine forest. I sniffed deeply, enjoying the crisp, resinous air, though it was turning chill toward dusk. We stopped for the night in a small clearing some way from the path. We scooped together a nest-like wallow of pine needles and blankets and huddled close together for warmth, covered by Jamie's plaid and blanket. He woke me sometime in the darkness and made love to me, slowly and tenderly, not speaking. I watched stars winking through the lattice of black branches overhead and fell asleep again with his comforting weight still warm on top of me. In the morning, Jamie seemed more cheerful, or at least more peaceful, as though a difficult decision had been reached. He promised me hot tea for supper, which was small comfort then in the frigid air. Sleepily, I followed him back to the path, brushing pine needles and small spiders from my skirt. The narrow path faded during the morning to no more than a faint trace through rough sheep's fescue, zigzagging around the more prominent rocks. I'd been paying little attention to our surroundings, but I dreamily enjoyed the growing warmth of the sun. But suddenly my eye struck a familiar rock formation, and I started out of my torpor. I knew where we were, and why. "Jamie!" He turned at my exclamation.
"You didn't know?"
he asked curiously. "That we were coming here?" "No, of course not." I felt mildly sick. The hill of Craigna Dun was no more than a mile away. I could see the humpback shape of it through the last shreds of the morning mist. I swallowed hard, I had tried for nearly 6 months to reach this place. Now that I was here at last, I wanted to be anywhere else. The standing stones on the hilltop were invisible from below, but they seemed to emanate a subtle terror that reached out for me. Well below the summit, the footing grew too uncertain for Donas. We dismounted and tethered him to a scrubby pine, continuing on foot. I was panting and sweating by the time he reached the granite ledge. Jamie showed no signs of exertion, save a faint flush rising from the neck of his shirt. It was quiet here above the pines, but with a steady wind whining faintly in the crevices of the rock. Swallows shot past the ledge, rising abruptly on the air currents in pursuit of insects, dropping like dive bombers, slender wings outspread. Jamie took my hand to pull me up the last step to the wide, flat ledge at the base of the cleft rock. He didn't release it, but drew me close, looking carefully at me, as though memorizing my features. "Why?" I began, gasping for breath.
"It's your place," he said roughly, "isn't it?"
"Yes." I stared as though hypnotized at the stone circle. It looked just the same. Jamie followed me into the circle. Taking me by the arm, he marched me firmly up to the split rock.
"Is it this one?" he demanded.
"Yes." I tried to pull away. "Careful! Don't go too near it." He glanced from me to the rock, clearly skeptical. Perhaps he was right to be. I felt suddenly doubtful of the truth of my own story. I don't know anything about it. Perhaps the whatever it is closed behind me. Maybe it only works at certain times of the year. It was near Beltane when I came through last. Jamie glanced over his shoulder at the sun, a flat disk hanging in mid-sky behind a thin screen of cloud.
"It's almost Psalm now," he said. "All Hallows' Eve. Seems suitable, no?"
He shivered involuntarily, in spite of the joke.
"When you came through, what did you do?"
I tried to remember. I felt ice cold, and I folded my hands under my armpits. I walked round the circle, looking at things. Just randomly, though. There was no pattern. And then I came near to the split rock, and I heard a buzzing like bees. It was still like bees. I drew back as though it had been the rattle of a snake. "It's still here!" I reared in panic, throwing my arms around Jamie, but he set me firmly away from him, his face white, and turned me once again toward the stone.
"What then?"
The keening wind was sharp in my ears, but his voice was sharper still. I put my hand on the rock.
"Do it then."
He pushed me closer, and when I didn't respond, he grasped my wrist and planted my hand firmly against the brindled surface. Chaos reached out and grabbed me. The sun stopped whirling behind my eyes at last, and the shriek faded out of my ears. There was another persistent noise. Jamie calling my name. I felt too sick to sit up or open my eyes, but I flapped my hand weakly to let him know I was still alive. "I'm all right," I said.
"Are you then?" "Oh, God, Claire. I thought you were dead, sure.
You began to go somehow.
You had the most awful look on your face, like you were frightened to death.
I pulled you back from the stone. I stopped you. I shouldn't have done so.
I'm sorry, lassie."
My eyes were open enough now to see his face above me, shocked and frightened. "It's all right." It was still an effort to speak, and I felt heavier and disoriented, but things were coming clearer. I tried to smile, but felt nothing more than a twitch. "At least we know it still works."
"Oh, God. Aye, it works."
He cast a glance of fearful loathing at the stone. He left me long enough to wet a kerchief in a puddle of rainwater that stood in one of the stony depressions. He wet my face, still muttering reassurances and apologies. At last, I felt well enough to sit up. You didn't believe me after all, did you? Groggy as I was, I felt somewhat vindicated. It's true, though.
Aye. It's true.
He sat next to me, staring at the stone for several minutes. I rubbed the wet cloth over my face, feeling still faint and dizzy. Suddenly he sprang to his feet, walked to the rock, and slapped his hand against it. Nothing whatsoever happened, and after a minute his shoulders slumped, and he came back to me. "Maybe it's only women it works on," I said fuzzily. "It's always women in the legends. Or maybe it's only me."
"Well, it isn't a me," he said. "Better make sure, though."
"Jamie, be careful!" I shouted, to no avail. He marched to the stone, slapped it again, threw himself against it, walked through the split and back again, but it remained no more than a solid stone monolith. As for myself, I shuddered at the thought of even approaching that door to madness once again. And yet when I'd begun to pass into the realm of chaos this time, I had been thinking of Frank, and I had felt him, I was sure of it. Somewhere in the void had been a tiny pinprick of light, and he was in it. I knew. I knew also that there had been another point of light, one that sat still beside me, staring at the stone, cheeks gleaming with sweat in spite of the chill of the day. At last he turned to me and grasped both my hands. He raised them to his lips and kissed each one formally.
"My lady," he said softly, "my Claire, it's no use in waiting. I must part with you now."
My lips were too stiff to speak, but the expression on my face must have been as easily readable as usual.
"Claire," he said urgently, "it's your own time on the other side of that thing. You've a home there, a place, the things that you're used to, and Frank."
"Yes," I said, "there's Frank." Jamie caught me by the shoulders, pulling me to my feet and shaking me gently in supplication.
"There's nothing for you on this side, lass. Nothing save violence and danger. Go."
He pushed me slightly, turning me toward the stone circle. I turned back to him, catching his hands. "Is there really nothing for me here, Jamie?" I held his eyes, not letting him turn away from me. He pulled himself gently from my grasp without answering, and stood back. Suddenly a figure from another time, seen in relief upon a background of hazy hills, the life in his face a trick of the shadowing rock, as if flattened beneath layers of paint, an artist's reminiscence of forgotten places and passions turned to dust. I looked into his eyes, filled with pain and yearning, and he was flesh again, real and immediate, lover, husband, man. The anguish I felt must have been reflected in my face, for he hesitated, then turned to the east and pointed down the slope.
"Do you see behind the small clump of oak down there, about halfway?"
I saw the clump, and saw what he was pointing at, the half-ruined crofter's cottage, abandoned on the haunted hill.
"I shall go down to the house, and I shall stay there till the evening. To make sure, to be sure, that you're safe."
He looked at me, but made no move to touch me. He closed his eyes as though he could no longer bear to look at me.
"Goodbye," he said,
and turned to go. I watched him, numb, and then remembered. There was something that I had to tell him. I called after him, "Jamie!" He stopped and stood motionless for a moment, fighting to control his face. It was white and strained, and his lips were bloodless when he turned back to me.
"Aye.
There's something... I mean, I have to tell you something before I go." He closed his eyes briefly, and I thought he swayed, but it might have been only the wind tugging at his kilt.
"There's no need," he said. "No. Do you go, lass? You shouldn't, Atari. Go."
He made to turn away, but I clutched him by the sleeve. Jamie, listen to me. You must. He shook his head helplessly, lifting a hand as though to push me away. Claire, no, I can't. The wind was bringing the moisture to his eyes. It's the rising, I said urgently, shaking his arm. Jamie, listen. Prince Charlie, his army. Colm is right. Do you hear me, Jamie? Colm is right, not Dougal.
Eh? What do you mean, lass?
I had his attention now. He rubbed his sleeve across his face, and the eyes that looked down at me were sharp and clear. The wind sang in my ears. Prince Charlie, there will be a rising. Dougal's right about that, but it won't succeed. Charlie's army will do well for a bit, but it will end in slaughter. At Culloden, that's where it will end. The clans. In my mind's eye, I saw the clan stones, the grey boulders that would lie scattered on the field, each stone bearing the single clan name of the butchered men who lay under it. I took a breath and gripped his hand to steady myself. It was cold as a corpse's. I shuddered and closed my eyes to concentrate on what I was saying. The Highlanders, all the clans that follow Charlie, will be wiped out. Hundreds and hundreds of the clansmen will die at Culloden. Those that are left will be hunted and killed. The clans will be crushed, and they'll not rise again. Not in your time. Not even in mine. I opened my eyes to find him staring at me, expressionless. Jamie, stay out of it, I begged him. Keep your people out of it if you can, but for the Lord's sake. Jamie, if you... I broke off. I had been going to say, Jamie, if you love me. But I couldn't. I was going to lose him forever, and if I couldn't speak of love to him before, I couldn't do it now. Don't go to France, I said softly. Go to America or to Spain, to Italy. But for the sake of the people who love you, Jamie, don't set foot on Culloden Field. He went on staring at me. I wondered if he had heard. Jamie, did you hear me? Do you understand? After a moment, he nodded numbly.
Aye, he said quietly.
So quietly I could hardly hear him beneath the whining of the wind.
Aye, I hear.
He dropped my hand.
Go with God, Madonna.
He stepped off the ledge and made his way down the steep incline, bracing his feet against tufts of grass, catching at branches to keep his balance, not looking back. I watched him until he disappeared into the oak clump, walking slowly like a man wounded, who knows he must keep moving, but feels his life ebbing slowly away through the fingers he has clenched over the wound. My knees were trembling. Slowly I lowered myself to the granite shelf and sat cross-legged, watching the swallows about their business. Below, I could just see the roof of the cottage that now held my past. At my back loomed the cleft stone and my future. I sat without moving through the afternoon. I tried to force all emotion from my mind and use reason. Jamie certainly had logic on his side when he argued that I should go back. Home. Safety. Frank. Even the small amenities of life that I sorely missed from time to time, like hot baths and indoor plumbing, to say nothing of larger considerations such as proper medical care and convenient travel. And yet, while I would certainly admit the inconveniences and outright dangers of this place, I would have also to admit that I had enjoyed many aspects of it. If travel was inconvenient, there were no enormous stretches of concrete blanketing the countryside, nor any noisy, stinking autos, contrivances with their own dangers, I reminded myself. Life was much simpler, and so were the people. Not less intelligent, but much more direct, with a few sterling exceptions like Columban Campbell Mackenzie, I thought grimly. Because of Uncle Lamb's work, I had lived in a great many places, many even cruder and more lacking in amenities than this one. I adapted quite easily to rough conditions and didn't really miss civilization when away from it, though I adapted just as easily to the presence of niceties like electric cookers and hot water geysers. I shivered in the cold wind, hugging myself as I stared at the rock. Rationality didn't appear to be helping much. I turned to emotion and began, shrinking from the task, to reconstruct the details of my married lives, first with Frank, then with Jamie. The only result of this was to leave me shattered and weeping, the tears forming icy trails on my face. Well, if not reason nor emotion, what of duty? I had given Frank a wedding vow and had meant it with all my heart. I had given Jamie the same, meaning to betray it as soon as possible. And which of them would I betray now? I continued to sit as the sun sank lower in the sky and the swallows disappeared to their nests. As the evening star began to glow among the black pine's branches, I concluded that in this situation reason was of little use. I would have to rely on something else. Just what? I wasn't sure. I turned toward the split rock and took a step, and then another, and another. Pausing, I faced around and tried it in the other direction. A step, then another, and another. And before I even knew that I had decided, I was halfway down the slope, scrabbling wildly at grass clumps, slipping and falling through the patches of granite scree. When I reached the cottage, breathless with fear lest he had left already, I was reassured to see Donas hobbled and grazing nearby. The horse raised his head and eyed me unpleasantly. Walking softly, I pushed the door open. He was in the front room, asleep on a narrow oak settle. He slept on his back, as he usually did, hands crossed on his stomach, mouth slightly open. The last rays of daylight from the window behind me limned his face like a metal mask. The silver tracks of dried tears glinted on golden skin, and the copper stubble of his beard gleamed dully. I stood watching him for a moment, filled with an unutterable tenderness. Moving as quietly as I could, I lay down beside him on the narrow settle and nestled close. He turned to me in sleep, as he so often did, gathering me spoon-fashion against his chest and resting his cheek against my hair. Half-conscious, he reached to smooth my hair away from his nose. I felt the sudden jerk as he came awake to realize that I was there, and then we overbalanced and crashed together onto the floor, Jamie on top of me. I didn't have the slightest doubt that he was solid flesh. I pushed a knee into his abdomen, grunting. "Get off! I can't breathe!" Instead, he aggravated my breathless condition by kissing me thoroughly. I ignored the lack of oxygen temporarily in order to concentrate on more important things. We held each other for a long time without speaking. At last he murmured, "Why?" His mouth muffled in my hair. I kissed his cheek, damp and salty. I could feel his heart beating against my ribs and wanted nothing more than to stay there forever, not moving, not making love. Just breathing the same air. "I had to," I said. I laughed a little shakily. "You don't know how close it was. The hot baths nearly won." And I wept then and shook a little, because the choice was so freshly made, and because my joy for the man I held in my arms was mingled with a tearing grief for the man I would never see again. Jamie held me tightly, pressing me down with his weight, as though to protect me, to save me from being swept away by the roaring pull of the stone circle. At length my tears were spent, and I lay exhausted, head against his comforting chest. It had grown altogether dark by this time, but still he held me, murmuring softly as though I were a child afraid of the night. We clung to each other, unwilling to let go, even long enough to start a fire or light a candle. At length, Jamie rose and picking me up, carried me to the settle where he sat with me, cradled on his lap. The door of the cottage still hung open, and we could see the stars beginning to burn over the valley below. "Do you know," I said drowsily, "that it takes thousands and thousands of years for the light of those stars to reach us? In fact, some of the stars we see may be dead by now, but we won't know it, because we still see the light."
"Is that so?"
he answered, stroking my back. "I didn't know that." I must have fallen asleep, head on his shoulder, but roused briefly when he laid me gently on the floor on a makeshift bed of blankets from the horse's saddle roll. He lay down beside me and drew me close again.
"Lay your head, lass," he whispered. "In the morning, I'll take you home."
We rose just before dawn, and were on the downward trail when the sun rose, eager to leave Craigna Dun. "Where are we going, Jamie?" I asked, rejoicing that I could look forward into a future that held him, even as I left behind the last chance of returning to the man who had, who would, once love me. Jamie reined in the horse, pausing to look over his shoulder for a moment. The forbidding circle of standing stones was invisible from here, but the rocky hillside seemed to rise impassable behind us, bristling with boulders and gorse bushes. From here, the crumbling husk of the cottage looked like one more crag, a bony knuckle jutting from the granite fist of the hill.
"I wish I could have fought him for you," he said abruptly,
looking back at me. His blue eyes were dark and earnest. I smiled at him, touched. "It wasn't your fight. It was mine. But you won it anyway." I reached out a hand, and he squeezed it.
"Aye, but that's not what I meant. If I'd fought him man to man and won, you'd need not to feel any regret over it."
He hesitated. "If ever..." "There aren't any more ifs," I said firmly. "I thought of every one of them yesterday, and here I still am."
"Thank God," he said, smiling, "and God help you."
Then he added,
"Though I'll never understand why."
I put my arms around his waist and held on as the horse slithered down the last steep slope.
"Because," I said, "I bloody well can't do without you, Jamie Fraser, and that's all about it. Now, where are you taking me?"
Jamie twisted in his saddle to look back up the slope.
"I prayed all the way up that hill yesterday," he said softly. "Not for you to stay. I didn't think that would be right. I prayed I'd be strong enough to send you away."
He shook his head, still gazing up the hill, a faraway look in his eyes.
"I said, 'Lord, if I've never had courage in my life before, let me have it now. Let me be brave enough not to fall on my knees and beg her to stay.'"
He pulled his eyes away from the cottage and smiled briefly at me.
"Hardest thing I ever did, Sassenach."
He turned in the saddle and reined the horse's head toward the east. It was a rare, bright morning, and the early sun gilded everything, drawing a thin line of fire along the edge of the reins, the curve of the horse's neck, and the broad planes of Jamie's face and shoulders. He took a deep breath and nodded across the moor, toward a distant pass between two crags.
"So now I suppose I can do the second hardest thing."
He kicked the horse gently, clicking his tongue.
"We're going home, Sassenach, to Lallybroch."
Part 5. Lallybroch. Chapter 26. The Laird's Return. At first, we were so happy only to be with each other and away from Leoch that we didn't talk much. Across the flat of the moor, Donas could carry us both without strain, and I rode with my arms about Jamie's waist, glorying in the feel of the sun-warmed muscle shifting under my cheek. Whatever problems we might be facing, and I knew there were plenty, we were together, forever, and that was enough. As the first shock of happiness mellowed into the glow of companionship, we began to talk again, about the countryside through which we were passing at first, then, cautiously, about me and where I had come from. He was fascinated by my descriptions of modern life, though I could tell that most of my stories seemed like fairy tales to him. He loved especially the descriptions of automobiles, tanks, and airplanes, and made me describe them over and over as minutely as I could. By tacit agreement, we avoided any mention of Frank. As we covered more countryside, the conversation turned back to our present time. Colum, the castle, then the stag hunt and the Duke.
"He seems a nice chap," Jamie remarked.
As the going became rougher, he had dismounted and walked alongside, which made conversation easier.
"I thought so, too," I answered, "but..."
"Oh, aye, you canna put too much faith in what a man seems these days," he agreed. "Still, we got on, he and I. We'd sit together and talk of an evening round the fire in the hunting lodge. He's a good bit brighter than he seems, for the one thing. He knows how that voice makes him seem, and I think he uses it to make himself look a bit of a fool, while all the time the mind is there, working behind his eyes."
That's what I'm afraid of. Did you tell him? He shrugged.
A bit. He knew my name, of course, from that time before, at the castle.
I laughed at the memory of his account of that time.
Did you, reminisce about old times?
He grinned, the ends of his hair floating about his face in the autumn breeze.
Oh, just a bit. He asked me once whether I still suffered from stomach trouble. I kept my face straight and answered that, as a rule, no, but I thought perhaps I felt a bit of griping coming on just now. He laughed, and said he hoped it didn't discommode my beautiful wife.
I laughed myself. Right now, what the Duke might or mightn't do didn't seem of overwhelming importance. Nevertheless, he might one day be of use.
"I told him a little," Jamie went on, "that I was outlawed but not guilty of the charge, though I'd have precious little chance of proving it. He seemed sympathetic, but I was cautious about telling him the circumstances, let alone the fact that there's a price on my head. I hadn't yet made up my mind whether to trust him with the rest of it when old Alec came tearing into the camp like the devil himself was on his tail, and Murta and I left the same way."
This reminded me. "Where is Murta?" I asked. "He came back with you to Leoch?" I hoped the little clansman hadn't fallen afoul of either Colum or the villagers of Cranesmere.
"He started back wi' me, but the beast he was riding was no match for Donas. Aye, a bonny wee lad ye are, Donas, Mubwiag."
He slapped the shimmering sorrel neck, and Donas snorted and ruffled his mane. Jamie glanced up at me and smiled.
"Dinna worry for Murta. There's a canty wee bird can mind for himself."
"Canty? Murta?"
I knew the word meant cheerful, which seemed incongruous to a degree. "I don't think I've ever seen him smile. Have you?"
"Oh, aye, at least twice."
"How long have you known him?"
23 years. He's my godfather."
"Oh. Well, that explains a bit. I didn't think he'd bother on my account." Jamie patted my leg.
"Of course he would. He likes you."
"I'll take your word for it." Having thus approached the subject of recent events, I took a deep breath and asked something I badly wanted to know. "Jamie?"
"Aye?"
"Gillis Duncan, will they really burn her?" He glanced up at me, frowning slightly, and nodded.
"I expect so. Not till after the child is born, though. Is that what troubles you?"
"One of the things. Jamie, look at this." I tried to push up the voluminous sleeve, failed, and settled for pulling the neck of the shirt off my shoulder to display my vaccination scar.
"God in heaven,"
he said slowly, after I had explained. He looked sharply at me.
"So that's why... Is she from your own time, then?"
I shrugged helplessly. "I don't know. All I can say is that she was likely born sometime after 1920. That's when public inoculation came in. I looked over my shoulder, but low-lying clouds hid the crags that now separated us from Leoch. I don't suppose I will ever know, now. Jamie took Donis's reins and led him aside under a small pine grove on the banks of a small stream. He grasped me around the waist and lifted me down.
"Dinna grieve for her," he said firmly, holding me. "She's a wicked woman, a murderer, if not a witch. She did kill her husband, no?"
"Yes," I said with a shudder, remembering Arthur Duncan's glazed eyes.
"I still don't understand why she should kill him, though," he said, shaking his head in puzzlement. "He had money, a good position, and I doubt he beat her."
I looked at him in exasperated amazement.
"And that's your definition of a good husband?"
"Well, yes,"
he said, frowning.
"What else might she want?"
"What else?" I was so taken aback, I just looked at him for a moment, then slid down on the grass and started to laugh.
"What's funny? I thought this was murder."
He smiled, though, and put an arm around me.
"I was just thinking," I said, still snorting a bit, "if your definition of a good husband is one with money and position who doesn't beat his wife, what does that make you?"
"Oh,"
he said. He grinned.
"Well, Sassenach, I never said I was a good husband. Neither did you. Sadist, I think you called me, and a few other things that I wouldna repeat for the sake of decency, but not a good husband."
"Good. Then I won't feel obliged to poison you with cyanide."
"Cyanide?"
He looked down curiously at me.
"What's that?"
"The thing that killed Arthur Duncan. It's a bloody fast, powerful poison. Fairly common in my time, but not here." I licked my lips meditatively. I tasted it on his lips, and just that tiny bit was enough to make my whole face go numb. It acts almost instantly, as you saw. I should have known then, about Geely, I mean. I imagine she made it from crushed peach pits or cherry stones, though it must have been the devil of a job.
"Did she tell you why she did it, then?"
I sighed and rubbed my feet. My shoes had been lost in the struggle at the loch, and I tended to pick up stickers and cockleburrs, my feet not being hardened as Jamie's were. "That, and a good deal more. If there's anything to eat in your saddlebags, why don't you fetch it, and I'll tell you all about it." We entered the valley of Broch Turach the next day. As we came down out of the foothills, I spotted a solitary rider some distance away, heading roughly in our direction. He was the first person I had seen since we had left Cranesmuir. The man approaching us was stout and prosperous-looking, with a snowy stock showing at the neck of a serviceable grey serge coat, its long tails covering all but an inch or two of his breeches. We'd been travelling for the best part of a week, sleeping out of doors, washing in the cold, fresh water of the burns, and living quite well off such rabbits and fish as Jamie could catch, and such edible plants and berries as I could find. Between our efforts, our diet was better than that in the castle, fresher, and certainly more varied, if a little unpredictable. But if nutrition was well served by an outdoor life, appearance was another thing, and I took hasty stock of our looks as the gentleman on horseback hesitated, frowning, then changed direction, and trotted slowly toward us to investigate. Jamie, who had insisted on walking most of the way to spare the horse, was a disreputable sight indeed. Hose stained to the knees with a reddish dust, spare shirt torn by brambles, and a week's growth of beard bristling fiercely from cheek and jaw. His hair had grown long enough in the last months to reach his shoulders. Usually clubbed into a queue or laced back, it was free now, thick and unruly, with small bits of leaf and stick caught in the disordered coppery locks. Face burned a deep ruddy bronze, boots cracked from walking, dirk and sword thrust through his belt, he looked a wild Highlander indeed. I was hardly better. Covered modestly enough in the billows of Jamie's best shirt and the remnants of my shift, barefoot and shawled in his plaid, I looked a right ragamuffin. Encouraged by the misty dampness and lacking any restraint in the form of comb or brush, My hair rioted all over my head. It had grown as well during my sojourn at the castle, and floated in clouds and tangles about my shoulders, drifting into my eyes whenever the wind was behind us, as it was now. Shoving the wayward locks out of my eyes, I watched the cautious approach of the gentleman in grey. Jamie, seeing him, brought our own horse to a stop and waited for him to draw near enough for speech. "It's Jock Graham," he said to me, "from up the way at Merchnarda." The man came within a few yards, reined up, and sat looking us over carefully. His eyes, pouched with fat, crinkled and rested suspiciously on Jamie, then suddenly sprang wide. "Lallybroch?" he said, unbelievingly. Jamie nodded benignly. With a completely unfounded air of proprietorial pride, he laid a hand on my thigh and said, "And my lady, Lallybroch." Jock Graham's mouth dropped an inch or two, then was hastily drawn up again into an expression of flustered respect. "Ah, my lady," he said, belatedly doffing his hat and bowing in my direction. "You'll be going home, then?" he asked, trying to keep his fascinated gaze from resting on my leg, bared to the knee by a rent in my shift, and stained with elderberry juice. "Aye." Jamie glanced over his shoulder, toward the rift in the hill he had told me was the entrance to Broch Turoch. "You'll have been there lately, Jock." Graham pulled his eyes away from me and looked at Jamie.
I have been there. They're all well. Be pleased to see you, I expect. Go well, then, Freezer."
And with a hasty dig into his horse's ribs, he turned aside and headed up the valley. We watched him go. Suddenly, 100 yards away, he paused. Turning in the saddle, he rose in his stirrups and cupped his mouth to shout. The sound, borne by the wind, reached us thin but distinct.
"Welcome home!"
And he disappeared over a rise. Broch Turoch means the north-facing tower. From the side of the mountain above, the broch that gave the small estate its name was no more than another mound of rocks, much like those that lay at the foot of the hills we'd been travelling through. We came down through a narrow, rocky gap between two crags, leading the horse between boulders. Then the going was easier, the land sloping more gently down through the fields and scattered cottages, until at last we struck a small winding road that led to the house. It was larger than I had expected, a handsome three-story manor of harled white stone, windows outlined in the natural grey stone, a high slate roof with multiple chimneys, and several smaller whitewashed buildings clustered about it like chicks about a hen. The old stone broch, situated on a small rise to the rear of the house, rose 60 feet above the ground, cone-topped like a witch's hat, girdled with three rows of tiny arrow-slits. As we drew near, there was a sudden terrible racket from the direction of the outbuildings, and Donas shied and reared. No horseman, I promptly fell off, landing ignominiously in the dusty road. With an eye for the relative importance of things, Jamie leapt for the plunging horse's bridle, leaving me to fend for myself. The dogs were almost upon me, baying and growling by the time I found my feet. To my panicked eyes, there seemed to be at least a dozen of them, all with teeth bared and wicked. There was a shout from Jamie.
"Bran! Luke! Whis!"
The dogs skidded to a halt within a few feet of me, confused. They milled, growling uncertainly, until he spoke again.
"Whis, Mumasha! Stand still, you wee heathen!"
They did, and the largest dog's tail began gradually to wag, once and then twice, questioningly.
"Claire, come take the horse. He'll not let them close, and it's me they want. Walk slowly, they'll no harm you."
He spoke casually, not to alarm either horses or dogs further. I was not so sanguine, but edged carefully toward him. Donas jerked his head and rolled his eyes as I took the bridle, but I was in no mood to put up with tantrums, and I yanked the rein firmly down and grabbed the headstall. The thick velvet lips writhed back from his teeth, but I jerked harder. I put my face close to the big, glaring, golden eye and glared back.
"Don't try it,"